so wonderful to be here and to see all these shining flowers in God's garden and to be celebrating the years of service that Diane has given as center leader. Will you please pray with me, O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. The way to tune up a room. Anybody who read the posting today knows that this is anniversary of the birthday of James J. Lin, otherwise known as Rajasi, chief disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda. And as many of you know, I've been working on some books of mothers, and one of them is Mothers Meeting with Saints, which will be stories of mothers meeting with these wonderful spiritual personalities. And there is a chapter on James Lin that's begun, and I've written an introduction, so I thought I would read to you the draft for that introduction. It begins with a quote from Paramahansa Yogananda. The balanced life of Mr. Lin may serve as an inspiration for all men. Conscientiously discharging the duties of his worldly life, Mr. Lin yet found time daily for deep meditation on God. The successful businessman became an illumined Kriya Yogi. Rajasi Janakananda, born James Jimmy J. Lin, had an extraordinary life by any measure. Physically, he was a specimen of activity, performing difficult hatha yoga positions with ease when in his 40s and 50s. Materially, his life was a rags-to-riches story, coming from a very poor circumstances to becoming a multimillionaire by his young 30s. Mentally, he accomplished in school and business were truly remarkable. While working full-time, he simultaneously attending law school and an accounting program. He passed a state bar exam before he finished law school, and he earned the highest marks on record on the state for the CPA exam. Spiritually, Rajasi was a titan of spiritual realization. His guru saying of all his disciples, Rajasi was the most highly realized, and that he had spent many previous lifetimes meditating in the rarefied Himalayan heights. Rajasi was a very important supporter of Master's work and organization, Self-Realization Fellowship. Those lean years of the Great Depression were naturally difficult for Master and the work he was here to accomplish. After Rajasi met Master in 1932, his financial support was important to the success and the future of Master's work. Even with the importance of that monetary support, there is a story that illustrates how much Master valued his great disciple for the intangibles he brought to God and Guru's work. Beyond the material, Master and a devotee were walking out of the Mount Washington headquarters building when they saw Rajasi meditating under the tree.
He indicated silence should be kept as they made their way past the meditating yogi. Out of earshot, Yoganandaji said that more important than all of Rajasi's financial gifts was the depth of meditation he was engaged in right at that moment. Mother and Rajasi had few but very important interactions. Unfortunately, Rajasi's life was cut short. He passed away February 20th, 1955, at 62 years of age. Living in Borrego Springs on a 600-acre ranch, he was discovered to have fast-growing brain tumors. It is all God's leela, his play. But Mother's life and the direction of Self-Realization Fellowship would have been very different had he survived for years to come. As a comparison, Rajasi's life continued to live until 1968. God's will is inscrutable in these situations. And as we will see, Mother's life took unexpected turns after Rajasi's passing. But God used everything she went through to fulfill a tremendous purpose, both for Mother and for the world. Mother tells of a very important meeting she had with Rajasi in 1954. Mother was down to Encinitas Hermitage with a fellow devotee. She had tried to arrange to see Rajasi, but he had brain tumor operations and was in recovery. However, God conspired to unexpectedly take Mother along a path at the Hermitage, where she had the darshan of the great Saint Lin, Master's spiritual successor. Rajasi walked up to Mother, gave her a hug, and said, "Oh Mildred, I am so glad to see you." He asked if Mother could come and see him the next day. She agreed, but when she came onto the Hermitage grounds, she was not allowed to meet with him. In fact, she was treated quite roughly. His attendant had said that Rajasi never hugged any woman. So what, we may ask, was the meaning of this completely unique gesture from this great God-man to Mother? And why he had been wanting to see Mother? We can only speculate now, since they were denied the opportunity to meet. We only know that Mother's life unfolded exactly as to the divine plan, and that even so-called obstacles cannot stop God from fulfilling his purpose. Master had said that Rajasi had his own disciples, and we know from Master and from other of his disciples the greatness of Rajasi Janakananda. Indeed, he proved to be a Westerner, a married householder, and a successful businessman were no bars to attaining the highest states of realization. New hope for new men, divine union, the yoga avatar Lahiri Mahashaya proclaimed, is possible through self-effort. Rajasi proved in his own life that modern life need not be a bar to knowing God, that, in fact, self-realization is the one indispensable ingredient for peace and happiness. And this is from a talk that Rajasi gave. "One of the blessings I have received in my friendship with Paramahansa Yogananda has been permanent relief from a state of nervousness, a state of strain, an inward state of uncertainty. I have gained calmness, peace, joy, and a sense of security that cannot come to anyone until he has found the true security of the soul. Heavenly is the company of a saint. Of all things that have come to me in life, I treasure most the blessings that Paramahansaji has bestowed on me." And to give some context for that, Rajasi was indeed a prodigy, intellectually and in business. And as I say, he was working full-time. He was going to law school at night, and he was also attending a CPA program. Can you imagine? Keeping all those balls balanced. And he passed the bar exam a year before
He completed his law courses. He got the highest scores the state had ever recorded in the CPA program, or the test that they give statewide. So he was a brilliant, brilliant man. And he was working for an insurance company, actually had interests up in this part of the country because it had to do with fire insurance for lumber mills. And it was called a reciprocal insurance company. And he was working for that company. He wasn't 30 years old yet, and the head of the company was having health problems, so he wanted to sell the company. And Rajasi approached him about buying it. He says, well, not only do you not have the means to buy this company, but you are still so young. And Rajasi had greatly impressed him, but he is still a relatively young man. He went to the bank, and the bank manager saw something extraordinary in him, and he personally guaranteed the loan that the bank gave to Rajasi as a down payment for the company. The man, the owner, took about a month to think about it, reflected on the qualities of this young man, and decided to sell him the company. And so Rajasi bought it and ended up paying off the loan in just a couple of years, where it had been spread out over many years. He increased the sales by hundreds of percent. And he is off to the races. And then he went and he found an oil field. They were asking for $50,000 for the lease. Nobody would touch it because you never knew whether you're going to get a dry well or something that's going to produce. And it was more money than people were willing to pay. But Rajasi had a good sense about it. And so he bought the lease, and it turned out to be one of the largest producing wells in Oklahoma. And so this is just the way this man's life went, and he became tremendously wealthy. But he couldn't sit still for a minute. If he ever sat down, he popped right back up. His mind was constantly going, and he is in a state of anxiety and uncertainty. Despite his success, despite his wealth, he was an unhappy individual. And he was looking for something, someone, who could give him some respite from this constant restlessness. His wife came to one of Master's talks and convinced her husband that she should go and see him. I think later on she regretted doing it because she ended up not being in favor of his being a disciple of Yogananda's. But anyway, he went. And the first night he listened. And the second night he was attracted enough to come back. And suddenly as he was listening, he realized that his body was completely still. He wasn't fidgeting his hands. His feet weren't running a race, even though he was sitting, as it often did. And not only was his body quiet, but his mind was quiet. And he entered into such a state of peace, and it was really profound for him. He met with Master, and the first time they met one-on-one, they meditated for 6 hours. Can you imagine? Man who had never meditated in his life couldn't hardly sit still for a minute. And there they were, meditating for 6 hours, and he became established in such a state of peace that had never left him from that moment on. And so he saw truly that Master had saved his life and definitely gave him what he was looking for. And he became a highly, highly realized yogi. And Master had said that Rajasi had spent many lifetimes meditating in the Himalayan heights as a Indian yogi, but that he had this desire to express himself and to experience the worldly success, and that drew him to this incarnation that he had. And he had that success, but he saw the limits of it. And this is the thing that Master taught, is that you can have success in this world, but real success comes from knowing God.
And that is the theme that he constantly brought forward. Master wanted us to lead balanced lives. We have to live in this world. We're householder yogis. Many of us have jobs that we maintain. We have households that we maintain. Many have children, and so on. And so all of these things require something of us. And we too have that fidgety kind of mind, sometimes called the monkey mind. And that goes all over the place. So to emulate Rajasi, to go inside and get established in that place of stillness, this is one of the things that happened for me when I was in a year of silence and solitude. Through going into that deeper silence, the inner peace that I had experienced nearly continuously before that, but not continuously, something inside the heart center, that place in the center of the chest, there was an inner stillness, there was an inner presence that became absolutely established in my consciousness. And this was one of the great gifts that I came away from having that time. Now, it's not easy when the mind is always active. And sometimes we're the strict disciplinarian with the mind. And we curb it, and we direct it, and we bring it back to center. Other times we might be more of the observer. But as you observe your thoughts, your feelings, everything that's flowing through you, you're not just simply getting caught up in whatever daydream, whatever thoughts or memories or projections into the future you might be having. You're looking at it as if you're in the projection booth. You're seeing the beam of light go out and display itself on the screen in the form of a movie. You're breathing. And you're aware that you are a witness to whatever it is that you are observing. This is a tremendous practice because as you take a step back from the content of your thoughts and your feelings and your experiences in this world, you take a step closer to your true self. Your true self is that part of you that has always existed, exists now, and will always exist. When you are in deep meditation, there will come times when you suddenly get a glimpse of that self, and you know that you have always existed. And as far back as you stretch your mind, as far forward as you stretch your mind, and in this very moment, you know that you exist. This is your true self. And so by observing these thoughts, these feelings, and not getting yourself involved in them, see, that's the key. It happens just in an instant, doesn't it? You're sitting there meditating, minding your own business, and suddenly some daydream comes up, and you're taking light years away. I had this experience for so many years where I would relive a particular moment in my life. It was going into the state championships of wrestling in my high school years. And I'd had a shoulder injury. And so when I wrestled multiple times a day, it got to be more and more sore and proved to be difficult. And I was wrestling, one of the top wrestlers in the state, and I ended up losing that match by 1 point, and some of it was due to the weakness in my shoulder. And I'd be sitting there meditating, and suddenly I was wrestling that match all over again. And I would come to, and my body would be contorted, and I would be straining with every muscle in my body while I'm sitting on my meditation blanket. And I would think, how crazy is this?
I'm rerunning this over and over again. There is some attachment in there. If I had only won that match, that would have taken me into a completely another level, and I may have done quite well then. That was the attachment. And so I had to let go. Now, it can seem like a small thing. It's not an earth-shattering thing. But apparently, it really stuck with me, even though I didn't think that I had that much attachment to it. And that is the thing. We don't have to go looking after our attachments. They come to our own door, thank you very much. They knock the door in and make themselves at home without us giving any say-so about it. All we have to do is be putting our mind on God, stilling our mind, and all of the past, any attachment, will come marching up. Now we can see that as, why am I being tortured by these things? But the truth is, we have set ourselves about in an intention. That intention is to go beyond all such attachments. And in order to make it so that we can let go of those things, they come to the surface instead of residing in the deep, dark subconscious mind. And they are looking for release. They are looking for release. So one of the things that we can do is we can see those thoughts flowing into a flame that is in front of us. It can flow up through the ajna, it can flow through the heart. We give it into the light, whatever it is, whether it is a desire, whether it is a fear, and we are a witness to it, and we are also directing it. We are giving it an avenue. And as we give it an avenue out away from us and into the light, then it begins to deplete it. When we just rerun it in our mind, we're adding new psychic energy to it. And so it's important that we not just rerun it over and over again, because that really does seem like Dante's Inferno. It seems like hell. So we give it some place to go. And out it goes. So sometimes we are the witness. Sometimes we are sternly directing the mind to course correct. Other times we are giving an avenue for these thoughts and feelings to go into the light, giving it to God, and thereby taking it out of the subconscious, offering it into the superconscious, and letting it no longer be a problem. It doesn't always happen in a day. Not at all. When we stick with it, Master used to say, when other people are done meditating, I'm just beginning. Think of that. Do you challenge yourself to go longer, to go deeper? It's not just length of time, of course, but there is something about a commitment of time that forces you to face yourself and to face these things that come up, your own restlessness, your own desire nature, your own fears. You have to have the time to put in. So Master loved to meditate, but he was also reminded by Ram Gopal Mazumdar, one of the most highly realized saints he writes about in the autobiography of a yogi. He didn't sleep for 24 years, meditating upon God. And he said, don't just be in love with meditation. Meditation has a purpose, and that is to realize God. So remember, meditation is a means to an end. A means to an end. But if you will take that, then you will get the results. And I would like to read to you some examples of Master writing to Rajasi when he was in India. And he had some rough times when he was there. You know, sometimes we think, well, if I were only in an ashram, or if it was somebody like Master, you know, it'd be easy. I wouldn't have all these problems. I wouldn't have these money problems. I wouldn't have these time problems. I wouldn't have these demands on me. But that's nothing what happens at all.
Master had to face everything plus. He had a large organization that he was responsible for. He had a commission from Babaji and from God and from Jesus to go out and spread these teachings. A part of him would have much rather been just simply walking beside the Ganges, meditating when he wanted to, enjoying nature and God in nature, and just have that life of simplicity. But he surrendered to God. At one point, he was so disillusioned with how things were going here in America that he thought of going back to India permanently. It was very, very difficult for him. And he took it to God. He took it to Divine Mother. And Divine Mother was his favorite aspect of God. He said, "Mother, what should I do here? I want to go back to India and leave all of this hornet's nest of activity." And he said that Divine Mother took him by the ear and said, "No such luck. You're staying here. And this is where you need to serve." So we think that somebody else's life is always so much easier. There's the story of the saint who was visiting a town, and so many people came and they told him their problems and their stories, and always there was the implication somebody else had it better off than they had it. So he gathered up the whole village and he said, "I'm going to give you a proposition. This is something you can do today. Put your troubles right here, right in the center. And you can select anybody else's troubles. And now they'll be your troubles. And if you think somebody else's life is so much better, so much easier, this is your chance." So people put their troubles in there. So many of them thought, "Oh, if I only had so-and-so's life, that'd be easy street." So one by one, they selected somebody else's troubles and they went away. And they were happy for a little while. And then they realized that person's burden was really actually quite difficult. And in many ways, it was worse than the burden that they had been carrying. And so they started coming back to the master. And they said, "I don't want this person's burden anymore. I want my old one." And so the master arranged for it to reverse then. And that's the way that we are. When we can fully accept God's will, in a moment, this life is perfectly designed for me. Whatever my human opinion about it, my likes and my dislikes, I'm here for a real purpose. And this is here to perfectly fulfill what my soul has said it wants. I have said I want my God realization. God has brought every particular person, every particular situation into my life to test me, to make me stronger. Because when I'm up against some obstacle, I have to dig deeper into God in order to find the answers, to get the strength, to be able to overcome everything that I need to overcome. It is the very obstacles, the things we complain the most about, that are actually our greatest aids towards spiritual realization. Now, I know you don't want to hear that, but it's the truth. And if you will accept it, it makes such a huge difference. So much of our life is spent complaining, either in words or in our own minds. I wish I didn't have to deal with this. I wish I didn't have to deal with that. And to think of accepting it as coming perfectly from God, designed perfectly for you. So Master was in India, and he was dealing with a lawsuit back in America, and he was having different
difficulties. Then his guru left the body. And he wasn't there when his guru left the body. He had gone to the Kumbh Mela. And he was actually in Calcutta, and another disciple had gotten a telegram for Master. And it said, come to me tonight. Urgent. And Master felt in himself that he was not to go that night. And he went the next morning, and on the way, he saw Sri Yukteswar in his third eye point, and he knew that he had left the body. Oh, did he feel guilty? Did he feel bad? He felt like he had missed seeing Sri Yukteswar, his divine guru, one last time before he left the body. And his guru had even sent a telegram to that nature. You see, you think somebody else has easy street. And boy, did he feel bad. And it didn't get resolved until Sri Yukteswar resurrected for him. And if you will see in the autobiography, he says how terrible he'd been feeling that he had gone to the Kumbh Mela and had not been with Sri Yukteswar when he left the body. And Sri Yukteswar gave him all the love of God. And that helped to assuage any difficulty, any pain, any self-reproach that Master had had toward himself. And then he started feeling all right about himself. Not only all right, but he felt blissful once again. So these are some excerpts that of him writing to Rajasi when he was in India. And Master writes, every thought, every action, even desire, has become a temple of God. The great silent God is playing hide and seek with me. God's joy is ever new and ever newly entertaining. Isn't that fun? And he goes on, I can hear carping criticism with as much equal joy as praise. I am in the praising and in the criticizing voice. I am both voices. They are unalterable without me. So you think about that. Somebody who complains about you. Somebody who finds fault with you. Can you find yourself equally in that voice as you do in the person who praises you? And this is a tough one. It really is. When somebody levels blame at us, it really seems to hit a spot. Either that, or we just push it away and we discount the individual. But to hear our own voice in that individual, that is to feel God in that individual. And if that person is finding fault, first of all, we can hear a voice of God in that voice. And secondly, we can use our discrimination. And maybe it tells us something about the individual who's talking about us. Maybe it says something about us. And we use our discrimination to know the difference. But to start with that first beginning, I hear God's voice through this criticism. I hear God's voice through this praise. Neither may be the truth, by the way. And then he writes, how wonderful to love everything, not in a passing way, but with deep concentration, until love opens a portal into the love which is everything. You know, we talk about divine love, and for years Mother talked about divine love. And I didn't really comprehend what it was that she was speaking of. It isn't until you experience divine love that it really begins to take you into new places, explore new levels of awareness that you had never experienced before. So when you think of divine love, don't put it into a little box. Oh, I think I know what that is. You don't know what it is. No one can know all that it is.
And when you experience it, it's tangible, it's real, it's powerful, it's life-changing, and you will absolutely want more of it. I can guarantee you of that. It's not just sentimentality. It's not just a feeling. It is God come to you as that love. And it is the truth when it says that God is life, love, excuse me, God is love, and love is God. He writes another time, "Last night I was in samadhi. My pulse, my heart stopped. My body was dead, and my life force, like a comet, sprang through the spinal tunnel and head into the blue heavens." Just imagine. Just imagine that your life force rises up like a comet through your spine, through the top of your head, and takes you out into all consciousness. That you experience that pure peace and joy. This is the sign of a master. All matter became my dead body, and within it I saw the light of all life. I find I am settled in bliss. I am awake in bliss, ever watching the body and mind when they are awake or sleeping, asleep or dreaming. And there's a funny story told by Hare Krishna, who is Master's nephew. He was, I believe, 15 years old at the time. And Master had made the statement that even when he was sleeping, he was awake. And I know something about that state. And so they decided to test him. A master was sleeping, as in Indian style. They're all in one big room, and they're all sleeping. So master's perhaps snoring away, obviously in a state of deep sleep. And these two boys get up, and they said, "Master." And out of this deep sleep, master said, "Yes." He was awake inside of there, even though he was asleep. Sleep and wake states become identical, one and the same. So let us not put any kind of small boxes around what our experiences might be. Sometimes we hear these stories and we think, that's so far beyond me. But as Master said, the same God that is in you is in me, and the same God that is in me is in you. That is, you might say, the devil or Satan who's coming in and saying, but you can't be that. It's not true. It's not true. You have that same power. It may be latent. But you have that same power, that same intelligence, that same consciousness that Master, Rajasi, Sri Yukteswar, Lahiri Mahashai, Babaji, Jesus, all the great masters, Papa. You have that same power of God inside of you. And to say that you don't is to deny the Christ, even as Peter did. So don't catch yourself saying it. Now, you don't want to just go about saying, well, I have the same, and you haven't really realized it. That does you no good. It just feeds the ego. But recognize that that potentiality is there, waiting and ready to get unleashed. What I have loved about this path from the very beginning, it's experiential. It is something here to be tasted, to be known, to become one with. Not just a set of philosophy or a new language to learn. Master was many times criticized for adapting yogic principles to Western world. But these are small-minded people who are culturally bound. Truth is universal. And And whether you can sit in a full lotus position or not does not determine what happens in your spine and your brain. Whether you can fully realize no God or not. And whether you are a Christian or Hindu, Buddhist, Islam, Parsi, it makes no difference. The Sikh masters had just the highest realization. And to say anything less is to demean the Christ inside of them. So let us wake up to the fact that God is striving to awaken Himself in you. He is calling to you, even in this moment. Arise, awake, it says in the Vedas. Arise and awake, even as Rajasi did. Busy, busy businessman. And as I say, from the stories we know, that his wife was not in favor, so he wouldn't meditate at home. He would come to work and he'd lock himself into the office. He'd come in early and he'd meditate deeply. And they wouldn't disturb him. They knew not to disturb him until he came out of his office. And he would be in these high states of realization. And as the posting talked about, Mother talked about being down for Kriya initiation. And Master's talking and instructing everybody on the Kriya breath. And as he's doing so, Rajasi takes a Kriya breath. And then he suddenly just slides down to the floor because he's out of the body. He's with God. Just like that. Just imagine being able to slip out of body consciousness, letting this little clay vessel to go. It's so small, it's so tiny compared to your cosmic consciousness. And once you compare and contrast the two, you think this body is just such a thing that lasts just for a little while. And it's so small, and its concerns are so small. No wonder I feel cramped in here. No wonder I don't feel like I'm really fulfilling my true potential. And so Rajasi, even though he had gained this tremendous wealth and prestige, nevertheless, he was completely unhappy. And you can imagine somebody who was subconsciously comparing his life to the Himalayas and living and experiencing cosmic consciousness, and then comparing that to living the life of a mere wealthy individual and how it didn't measure up. There was something so important that was missing, and he knew it, and he was searching. The reason we have centers and the reason that we come together is that we support and love each other in these teachings. And as Jesus said, you know, in the old Judaism, there is a quorum, and I believe the quorum was 9 people. And it didn't count on some level unless you had 9 people. But Jesus said, where 2 or more are gathered, there I am. And the truth be told, where 1 or more are gathered would be the same thing. But there is a power. There is a synergy that happens when we come together. When we all have our minds focused on God. And it builds. And we can build a vibrancy in a room. It can become powerful. It can become surcharged with divine vibration. And one thing we have to be careful of is that not to bleed it out afterwards through talk and too much laughter. It's fine to have some social time. I'm sure we will today. But to hold a certain reserve inside of you, to hold a certain amount of that divine consciousness that just doesn't get ejected out through becoming too energetic. Hold a place for God inside of you. hold that stillness. Hold that peace, that joy, that uplifted feeling. Carry it with you into the world. And you will know such happiness, such peace. So we have these centers for this purpose, and we should utilize them. You know, this world is a tough place, and we can take some pretty rough knocks and shocks. But when we come together, we set aside all the things of the world, and we build that synergy, and we support each other, we love each other. And my heart goes out to all the center leaders. And to Diane, my heart goes out to you. Because you have been so faithful and so sincere and with such a desire to serve. You know, Mother said when she first started the Seattle Center, sometimes it was just her and one other person, and sometimes it was just her. That would be there for a meeting. But she always kept her appointment with God. And it grew gradually over time. Now, I've not been so interested in increasing numbers of people. What I'm really interested in, those sincere ones who really want to go to work and change their lives and to know God. And so whether there is one or two or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000, but I'd much rather have one sincere soul than 10,000 so-sos. Because I've seen it. I've seen things grow. And there's subgroups, and there's all kinds of things, machinations, that begin to happen, and people begin to maneuver for position and authority, and ego grows. And believe me, I think that there's a safety in small numbers. There's a sincerity there. Now, it's possible to have 10,000 sincere souls. Wouldn't that be lovely? But I'd much rather have one than 10,000 so-sos. So let us value these times. Jerry is going to take over as center leader. She will be holding meetings at her home. And I encourage you to make it your own. We can study master's lessons. We can make it so that it's living, alive, vibrant, meaningful to each one of us. It is our duty not to let it become a dead thing. That's a horrible thing. As Sri Yukteswar said, it's like a beautiful dead woman. What's the use of that? To have that inner life thriving, growing, reaching out for more. When you think that God is all of life and all of life is God, all of that life energy, all that creativity, all that intelligence that you see all around you in this world, it's all just a tiny, tiny little subset of what God is. And all of that is in you, in seedling form. Just think of what there is to explore inside of you, and yet we just stay on the surface. So let us dedicate ourselves anew. Bring ourselves into a new state of realization. Challenge ourselves every day. Okay, God, what do you have for me today? What do you have for me today? What's fresh? What's new? I'm open. I'm game. I'm here. I'm counting myself in, both feet in. And to open ourselves to God's will, what He would have for us that day. And I will guarantee there will be some moment, there will be some touch, there will be some upliftment that will charge you, that will change your life. Now, it may come in a very subtle way, but you'll know it. It may be an affirmation of God saying, I am with you always. What greater message is there than that? I am with you always. It may lift you up like a tornado, like a shooting comet, as Master says here. Or it may come in the softest of whispers, just like a gentle, gentle little breeze. Don't judge it. God is equally in the breeze as he is in the storm. Equally. And you will get value from both. I'd like to close with this lovely book that Mother used to read from quite often, called God Calling. And it's written by someone who used to tune into the Christ every day, and the Christ would speak. And this is entitled Sublime Audacity. The way is long and weary. It is a weary world. So many today are weary. Come unto me, and I will give you rest. My children, who range yourselves under my wing, you must see that it is on it are inscribed these words, the Son of Man. Whatever the world is feeling, I must feel. I, the Son of Man. You are my followers. So the weariness of man today must be shared by you. The weary and the heavy laden must come to you and find that rest that you have found in me. My children, my followers, must be prepared not to sit on my right hand and on my left hand, but to drink of the cup that I drink. Poor world, teach it that it is only one cure for all of life, union with me. Dare to suffer. Dare to conquer. Be filled with my sublime audacity. Remember that claim, Sometimes God lifts me up so much he makes my eyes close, which isn't good for being able to read, I can tell you. Claim the unclaimable. Just what the world would think impossible can always be yours. Remember, my children, sublime audacity. And so that is what I would like each one of you to claim, is that sublime audacity, and to know God, and then to come together and to worship him and love him and strive with all of your heart, mind, and soul. Have that sublime audacity and claim your oneness with God, that he is dwelling in you. He is calling to you. You would not be on this path if he were not calling to you, even now. If you please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss. Of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
I bow to the light within you.